All right, here we go. One, two, three, four, five. I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact. Sepp Herberger once said, "The ball is round, the game lasts 90 minutes, everything else is pure theory." As the World Cup kicks off in Brazil, we're going to take a closer look at the beautiful game. There are probably few better examples of the many sides of soccer than Sepp Herberger himself. The West German 1954 World Cup winning coach's admission into Germany's Sports Hall of Fame was greeted with not a small amount of controversy because of his previous ties with the Nazi Party. On this edition of Making Contact, we're going to look at the good, the bad, and the ugly side of the beautiful game. To start with, the ball is round, but do you know where it comes from? If you own a soccer ball, chances are that it was made in one of four places. Before 2000, Pakistan made 75% of all the soccer balls on the planet. Its market share has dropped a lot since then as manufacturing has shifted to China, India, and Thailand, but the country is still responsible for about 40% of all soccer balls on the market.
I don't stitch footballs at home because I don't want my children to live like me. Football is a game and a source of enjoyment for players and others, while a source of living for my family. I love football because I know if I didn't stitch footballs, then my family wouldn't eat that day.
At this moment, I am very happy to say that we have increased the production of football, not only in my factory, but in all city, in the whole city, all factories. Have nearly about 35% of an increase in their production because of the World Cup.
That's soccer ball factory owner Professor Safdar Sandal, and before him, Ghafoor Hussain, a worker in one of the factories. They both spoke with reporter Gabe Matthews in the town of Sialkot, Pakistan. Every 4 years, the World Cup brings a welcome boost in sales for companies in the town. As Nasser Doga explains, the town has a long history of making soccer balls.
This place has been famous from ages for the production of sports goods, especially the soccer balls. And it is said that, you know, this skill or this, this is about century old. This is the hub of football production and sports goods production in Pakistan.
Legend has it that Sialkot's industry kicked off after a local man repaired a ball for a group of British colonial officers. A gold soccer ball greets visitors at the entrance to the town, and there's clearly a lot of local pride about the industry, which provides employment to people like Mohammed Idris.
I don't have any other skills to earn money. I would roam around the city and would be begging beside the road if there was no football manufacturing factory in our village. I work for myself and for the good reputation of my country.
But Sialkot's association with soccer ball manufacturing has not always been a positive one. Dugar is the head of the Independent Monitoring Association for Child Labour, an organisation founded in the 1990s to address serious abuses within the industry.
And at that point in time, there was a lot of pressure on the football industry, saying that, and this pressure was basically from the consumers or the international buyers. And the pressure was that they thought that, you know, children were involved in the production of soccer balls. From Sialkot and all the big brands, they said that, you know, if you don't do anything about this issue, we would not buy balls from you. So that was the pressure.
In February 1997, the World Federation of the Sporting Goods Industry, the International Labour Organization, UNICEF, and the Sialkot Chamber of Commerce signed the Atlanta Agreements, establishing the monitoring organization Dugar runs. He says, for the most part, the agreement has worked.
Virtually, there has been no child labor for the last many years in this industry, at the scale when this program was introduced back in 1997-98.
Pakistani-based advocacy groups have raised concerns that children are instead working in the town's brick factories. But for the most part, it seems they are no longer involved in soccer ball manufacturing. Still, that doesn't mean the work is easy. Pay is by the ball, and the rate is low.
It was very tough to stitch footballs, and we would get very little. I would earn barely $1.50 a day. It was impossible to manage while stitching footballs. The contractor would cut the amount if he found a minor fault in the football. It was cruel. We did not have the courage to even ask why we got less money for doing this tough job.
Ask anyone involved in soccer ball manufacturing and they'll tell you much the same thing, that this is supplemental work that has traditionally been done when there's less agricultural work. Gabe Matthews asked Dr. Sarfaz Bashir, president of the Sialkot Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
Football play a very good role in the economy of Pakistan, and approximately 500 to 700 million dollar annually is related with the football. So we export this much from Pakistan.
But if we have seen in the villages the life of the person who makes the football, I mean, with hands, yeah, is deplorable. He gets just only 80 or 85 rupees a day.
No. This is a supplement to his income, and this keeps him independent, and this supplements his income. He may be doing some other job, and he can work and sue football in the evening, and maybe he can educate his family, his wife, to assist him.
When it comes to soccer balls and the World Cup, there's pretty much only one name in the business, Adidas. For more than 40 years, the company has been making soccer balls for use in the international tournament, and every World Cup ball has its own name. The Telstar, the Tango, the Azteca, the Etrusco, the Questra, the Tricolor, the Fever. For the 2014 World Cup, the ball is the Brazuca. Adidas declined to be interviewed for this program, but confirmed that Brazuca balls will be made in Sialkot. They just won't be used on the pitch in Brazil. Those balls will be made in China. So you won't see a Sialkot ball on the pitch in Brazil. But another ball from Sialkot will be getting some play, even if it's not going to be getting quite as much attention. So, I have here a Sender soccer ball. It's got that fantastic new soccer ball smell to it. Tell me about this ball.
Yeah, so the ball that you're holding right now is Valor XLS. It's one of our high-end training balls. It's a 32-panel
ball. That's Santiago Hulti, founder of the Fairtrade soccer ball company Sender. In 2014, his company expects to make anywhere from 30 to 40,000 balls in Sialkot. That's nothing compared to the bigger brands, but Santiago says Senda's goal is all in its name.
The name of Senda comes from a Spanish word that could translate into path, P-A-T-H. So the idea with Senda is that we're creating a new path for the producers, for the workers to improve their lives. We see the soccer industry and the athletic industry as the path to change people's lives.
Each Sender ball has the distinctive Fairtrade USA symbol on it. Since it started in 2010, Sender has been monitored by the Fairtrade USA organization to check it meets their standards.
So the goal right now with Fairtrade standard is to make sure that people who are making soccer balls and are working 8 hours a day for 5 days a week, that the equivalent of how much they earn per piece is at least the minimum wage in Pakistan. So that's what we're trying to do, and that's not often the case across the industry. And then on top of that, we have the fair trade premium that we pay per piece that goes to the community fund that workers can decide how to use on the fair price shop, backpacks for their children, maybe doctor visits for workers that maybe need eye exams. These community funds are the ones that complement this effort to make sure that people are making at least the Pakistani minimum wage when they're making balls for 8 hours a day for 5 to 6 times a week.
For Nasser Doga, Fairtrade could change the soccer ball making industry for the better if they can sell enough soccer balls.
It has a great potential because, you know, they make sure the due rights of workers are given to them. And whereas, you know, that kind of monitoring or that kind of audit is not here as far as other productions are concerned, or non-fair trade production is concerned. So if there is more fair trade production here, definitely that will help the workers to get their due rights. But I think the consumption of fair trade balls in the world market is not that much. So there are some producers here who are fair trade certified, but the orders that they get for fair trade balls is not very high. So that has been a problem here.
As with child labour, it all comes down to consumer pressure again. If there isn't enough demand for fair trade soccer balls, then the idea won't get off the ground. And as Halti readily points out, there are still a lot of questions to be asked about some of the fundamental aspects of the whole industry.
So the industry standard for soccer balls, it's per unit price and per unit payment for the workers. You know, these are things that eventually there's a lot of debate whether this is fair or it's not fair. You know, what happens when the factory has lower orders?
So is fair trade really that much better?
The difference between a fair trade ball and a conventional non-fair trade ball has to do with ensuring that you work with a third-party certifier that's really out there to make a difference, that has the experience of having transformed other industry, like coffee, like tea. These were industries that used to have a lot of the same problems that the soccer industry has, where you have, in the case of coffee, farmers being paid very little money for their crop, and you have like children. We are working with a model that has successfully improved other industries, and we're trying to bring that model of fair trade into the soccer ball industry.
Grab yourself a halftime snack, and we'll be right back after the break. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Sports journalist Dave Zirin's latest book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy, takes a closer look at the lead-up to the tournament. Dave Zirin spoke to Making Contact from his home in Washington, D.C., and I began by asking him why he first became interested in the World Cup.
Well, the World Cup is the closest thing to an internationally unifying event that we have on the planet. So I'm always interested in the World Cup and the effect it has on different countries and its ability to both bring people together and tear people apart. When I heard the World Cup was coming to Brazil in 2014 and the Olympics coming to Rio in 2016, with Brazil as a backdrop, it just seemed like too perfect a setting for an analysis as to what I call the three D's when it comes to hosting these kinds of events. I mean, any country that hosts these events, World Cup, the Olympics, these kind of sporting mega events, you always have the three D's. You have displacement, you have debt, and you have defense. And I put defense in quotes, and that just basically means the militarization of the country. And I was curious about how the three D's would play out in the context of a Brazil that is a relatively young democracy, that has an exploding economy, and that has a huge social inequality.
You covered several other World Cups and Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about the way that the 3Ds, as you call them, are being manifested on the ground in Brazil.
Yeah, sure. And just to be clear, there have been other countries that have done it back to back. Most recently, the United States hosted the World Cup in 94 and then the Atlanta Olympics in 96. But that was very different for two reasons. I mean, the first is that Atlanta was not an epicenter for the World Cup, while Rio is an epicenter for both the World Cup and the Olympics. And secondarily, the entire Olympic World Cup project has changed dramatically since 9/11. Because of the need to militarize a country, the need to create hyper-surveillance and all the rest of it. So what's happening in Brazil? Well, first of all, it's going to be more expensive than every other World Cup combined. The current price tag is over $15 billion. That's an unbelievable cost that's being put on the country. And the debt that's going to be accrued is going to be paid off for a generation. And that's why you have seen these kinds of protests take place in the last year. I mean, there are mass protests, the largest protests Brazil has seen in 20 years. And these protests started over the issue of bus fares in Sao Paulo, but it quickly became this crystallizing issue, this idea that stadiums were being built and issues like healthcare and education were going unattended. And the signs that people had, "We want FIFA quality hospitals, we want FIFA quality schools," was just a brilliant play on FIFA's demand coming into Brazil. Because, I mean, they demanded that Brazil build new stadiums. Brazil is not a country with a shortage of soccer stadiums. But FIFA comes in and they say, "We want FIFA quality stadiums." And that's code for you better tear down and you better rebuild, even the Maracanã, the most famous stadium, arguably, on the face of the earth in Rio.
And as you mentioned, these are issues that existed prior to the World Cup and prior to the Olympic Games. What do you think the role of those mega sporting events is in terms of accelerating the things that are happening in Brazil now, or it solidifying them?
That's a great question. I mean, and to answer that question, we have to understand that Brazil has long had some of the most powerful squatters' rights laws in the world. Because once slavery was abolished in Brazil at the end of the 19th century, where a lot of slaves came in from the countryside, former slaves, and the favelas were where they settled. And they settled on the hills. The hills were seen as very undesirous living because of both mudslides and because, well, that's where the poor people were going, and the rich tended to live at the bottom of these hills. And for decades, through periods of democracy and through periods of dictatorship, Brazil maintained these strong squatters' rights laws. So people, for generations, built on these homes, which is why it's such a mistake to call favelas slums, because there's a lot of history and tradition and infrastructure that have gone in there. So if you've got a period of unemployment, what a lot of people did was they just built up their home. And what you have right now with the coming, with both the combination of Brazil's growing economy, the speculative real estate boom, and the World Cup, is you have the opportunity for elites in Brazil to create what they call a state of exception, which means that they can make an effort to get around those squatters' rights laws, remove people from their homes, and either develop infrastructure, particularly for the World Cup or the Olympics, like parking lots or stadiums, or start looking ahead and start thinking about what it would be like to have high-end living on the hills of Rio, which would make it more like a traditional city like, say, Los Angeles, where, you know, where do the wealthy live in Los Angeles? They don't live in the valley, they live on the hill. And it's that kind of real estate model that they're trying to transpose onto Rio right now and in cities across of Brazil, which we have to remember as we talk about Brazil, it's larger than the continental United States.
To find out more about one of the three Ds, displacement, we go now to Zoe Sullivan, who has been speaking with some of those evicted from their homes to make way for World Cup construction.
A forced eviction in the neighborhood of Camaragibe on the outskirts of Recife. Evictions like this one have removed scores of families from this community. Only a few now remain in their homes, surrounded by swaths of the neighborhood that have been leveled, leaving only concrete slabs and rubble. This is all part of massive public works to get Brazil ready for the World Cup. This eviction was to make way for the expansion of a public transit terminal, but cost roughly 170 families their homes. For Gianni da Silva, who has lived in the community for 9 years, the construction is putting a lot of strain on residents.
Ninguém nunca foi contra as obras de expansão para a Copa.
No one was ever against the expansion work for the Cup, as long as it was done in a way that respected everyone's dignity and rights. Every resident here built his house. He built his house making many sacrifices, often even going hungry. And now he's choosing between paying rent and eating.
Massive protests in Brazil's major cities last year signaled to the world that all was not quite right in the country that, having brought home 5 trophies, is probably most closely associated with the World Cup. Amnesty International estimates that 19,000 people have lost their homes in Rio alone as a result of construction related to the World Cup and Olympics. It's the displacement of thousands of people from their homes and businesses, as well as huge cost overruns, that have got people questioning the decision to host the world's biggest soccer tournament. In Recife, one of the 12 host cities for the Games later this year, urban planners estimate that approximately 3,000 people have lost their homes to infrastructure projects related to the World Cup.
As cidades passam por um processo de neoliberalismo. The cities are going through a profound process of neoliberalization, and the World Cup just accelerates that. It highlights it.
Ana Ramadio teaches architecture and urban planning at the Federal University in Recife. She told Making Contact that these evictions are part of a much bigger picture.
The cup is just a tool about which people don't think very critically. It's so nice to have the World Cup in Brazil, but they don't see the process behind what's going on.
Camarijibe is a municipality on the edge of Recife that sits near the new 44,000 capacity soccer stadium built for the tournament.
As pessoas estão sendo desapropriadas, então estão tendo que abandonar as casas sem receber.
People are being dispossessed, so they have to leave their home to get the compensation. We're seeing lots of people. Many people have left their homes. They received the judicial official notifying them that they have to abandon their homes. But if someone refuses, they threaten to return with the police. So roughly 80% of the families have abandoned their homes without receiving a cent.
The homes were demolished months ago, but dozens of residents are still waiting for compensation. The state's attorney general says that issues with the legal status of ownership is what has led to lower assessments and slower payouts than people would like. Now, officials have also announced that the transit hub the houses were demolished to make way for will not be completed in time for the games. Da Silva and others have commented on the death toll among the community's elderly, who've seen their homes taken and destroyed. Manuel and Maria Cardoso lived in their home, demolished in November, since they married in 1975. She describes a conversation she had with a bailiff.
The court official arrived and my husband said that we didn't have anywhere to live. What should we do? We didn't have a place to live, so we didn't want to leave. We didn't want to be evicted. Where would we go? The street? We didn't even have a bridge to live under.
The Cardozos live on a single fixed pension of roughly $300 a month, half of which now goes to pay for their rent. Mr. Cardoso also has health issues and must purchase some of his medications out of pocket, leaving little for the couple to survive on. When I spoke with them, they hadn't received compensation for their home. Edizio Martins da Silva is the caretaker for his wife's 81-year-old father, who bought the original plot in Camarijibe. He says the process was handled badly from the start and describes what he sees as the low compensation offered to a neighbor.
Not long ago, he wanted to sell his house for 90,000, and his house was assessed at 42,000 reals. Where's a person going to find a house like this, near everything, for 42? Get it? Where are you going to find a house here, anywhere, for 42,000 reals? It's an invasion.
Despite the pressure to finish the infrastructure projects in time for the World Cup, some communities have managed to hold off evictions. The community of Coqui, which lies near the center of Recife, also found itself in line for demolition. Residents took to the streets, blocking major roads, and eventually managed to negotiate a solution with the state. The new transit hub, to serve hordes of soccer fans, will expand just the same, but dozens of family and businesses have been able to stay put. Luis Carlos da Silva Costa was one of the people who fought for the right to stay.
My name is Luis Carlos da Silva Costa, commonly known here as Carlos Bike because of my business.
Carlos Bike has lived and worked in Coqui his entire life. For years, he's run a small bicycle shop, repairing and selling bikes to area residents. He says he plans to stick around for the World Cup, but is concerned about the rising rents and higher property prices it brings.
I can stay in the area, and prices are going to go up. There's a lot of speculation. Before this, it wasn't worth anything. The speculation is huge when the compensation is unfair. They give whatever, and we don't even have enough to start over. That's really hard. Now I'm much more serene.
While Carlos has managed to save his business, his story is the exception, and frustration and anger still bubbles beneath the surface in communities like Camarijibe. A February poll found that only 52% of the population now supports the World Cup. In a country known for its love of soccer, it seems that many have little enthusiasm for the cost of hosting its biggest tournament. Zoe Sullivan, Making Contact, Recife, Brazil.
As we just heard, construction in Brazil has resulted in hundreds of people losing their homes. But how much of the blame lies with soccer's international governing body, FIFA? I asked journalist and author Dave Zirin.
It starts with FIFA and the demands that FIFA makes on a given country. There's that old expression, the greatest, the book's called Brazil's Dance with the Devil. And there's that old expression, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing us that he didn't exist. FIFA has done a great job over the years of convincing host nations that they don't exist. And that if there's anything that people don't like, well, you just blame the politicians in power. And of course, politicians in power bear their share of accountability. But the starting point is the demands that FIFA makes on a country and the demands, in the case of the Olympics, that the IOC makes. That's the starting point. When you talk about the kind of defense budget that they demand, when they talk about the kind of infrastructure that they demand, they are creating a situation where they are almost like a stateless actor coming into your country.
And you end your book with a poem from Eduardo Galeano. Do you want to read that poem for us?
Sure. I mean, I make no bones about being a poet or someone who has any alacrity at reading poetry, and Galeano is one of my favorites, but if you'll indulge me, I'm happy to read it. It's called The Nobodies by Eduardo Galeano, who I quote throughout my book. The nobodies, nobody's children, owners of nothing. The nobodies, the no ones, the no-bodied, running like rabbits, dying through life, screwed every which way. Who are not but could be, who don't speak languages but dialects, who don't have religions but superstitions, who don't create art but handicrafts, who don't have culture but folklore, who are not human beings but human resources, who do not have faces but arms, who do not have names but numbers, who do not appear in the history of the world but in the police blotter of the local paper, the nobodies who are not worth the bullet that kills them.
Thank you. And who are the nobodies in Brazil, and what do they have to do with this World Cup?
The nobodies because they're not being considered. So you have thousands upon thousands of people being displaced from their homes. You have workers dying in the construction of the stadiums. You have people having their lives militarized within an inch of their lives, and they don't become a consideration. The considerations become the tourists coming in. The consideration becomes the needs of FIFA. The consideration becomes how Brazil looks to an international audience. And meanwhile, you have a vibrant, rich, beautiful country of 200 million people. And somehow they're not at the center of this discussion. They're on the fringes of it.
Dave Zirin is a sports columnist for The Nation magazine. His latest book is Brazil's Dance with the Devil. Dave Zirin, thank you very much for speaking with Making Contact.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Andrew Stelzer, Jasmine Lopez, Laura Flynn, Quan Booth, and Barbara Barnett. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.